And if you have your Bible, then you can turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. We are, for the fourth Sunday in a row, in a series of six, looking into Hebrews 11, because this is Mateo month. This is the month we revisit an idea that we invented last year, considering the M and the A and the T and the E, that is the money that we have been given by God and the abilities, the time that we have been given, and the energy as signals and as the means of taking opportunities to serve God. We're looking at that this year from Hebrews chapter 11 under the heading of faith. We're exploring the ways in which the nature of our faith will determine the ways in which we make use of our money and abilities, our time and our energy, the opportunities we take because we have the means by which we could take them. And so we started a few weeks ago with verse 1, which is obviously the introductory verse and is the foundational truth that we're building this series and this understanding upon. Hebrews 11, 1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Which is to say that if our faith is biblical faith, if we have the sort of faith that the Bible says we need in order to please God, it should tend towards our assurance, that it should assure us, it should make us people who are real sure about things that we're hoping for. And by the same token, it should make us people who are convinced of some invisible things, convinced of things not seen. And what we've seen already is that there are two ways in which some things that are invisible we should be convinced of. Some things that are invisible we should be convinced of, though they're invisible because they're spiritual. They're spiritual and not physical or material things, but though we can't see them, we're convinced that they're there. And of course, the great big invisible thing is not a thing at all, but a person. It's God. He is immortal and invisible, but faith means being convinced that he in fact exists. And the other sort of invisible thing that we need to be convinced of and will be convinced of if we are people of faith are things that are not visible because they're not here yet. They're not present. They're future things. But similarly, real faith, the kind of faith that God is looking for and calling us to, the kind of faith that God himself must build into our hearts and minds, is the sort of faith that is convinced that certain things that are not present will one day be present. Things that are not yet here will be here. Future things, things we hope for, are real as well. And this morning, as we continue to dip into the book of Hebrews, and chapter 11 in particular, to see heroes or great examples of faith, we get to verses 8 to 10, and here are some notes, four notes in fact, about one particular notable person of faith, that is Abraham, and how his opportunities were provided for him by his wealth and his abilities, his time and his energy. Here are four notes on Abraham, two which cover previous principles, so a sort of standing review, and then two that take us into more details so that we can compare ourselves to him and sort out whether or not we seem to be people of faith, and the opportunities we take are proving it. Okay, so firstly, we get something about the nature of faith, which we've seen already from note number one. Abraham's experience links faith and obedience. Really important to see that if you're talking biblical faith, you're talking about a faith that leads to obedience. This we get from the first eight verses of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. By faith, it says, Abraham obeyed when he was called. Now, this is the great story, the great turning point in Abraham's life. He was living in a very godless society, in a very godless part of the world, and then the call of God came to him. And God called him to leave where he was going and go to someplace new, and because he was, at that point in his life, a person of faith, he obeyed. That's the point. Abraham's experience links faith and obedience. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called. By faith, Abraham obeyed. There's an implication there. By faith he obeyed. The implication would be sort of a question. Is there such a thing as someone who would obey God, but not by faith? Because what sets Abraham aside from the crowd is that when he was called, he obeyed in a distinct way. And the distinction was faith. It was by faith that Abraham obeyed. So the implication is a question. And a very important question for each of us who would consider ourselves, in some ways at least, believers or people of faith. The implication, the question is, in fact, is there a sort of obedience that isn't the result of faith? Could we be obeying God, though not by faith? It's a really good question because it helps us to sort out what it is we're doing and whether or not we are who we think we are and we are what we think we are. Is there a sort of obedience that isn't the result of faith? Look, we know, if we know the New Testament at all, that there's such a thing as faith without works, right? In the New Testament book of James, there's this big point made about how if your faith doesn't result in action, then it's not real faith at all. Faith without works is dead. We know that. But can there be works without faith? And is works without faith dead? Or is doing the right thing for any reason better than not doing the right thing? Fact of the matter is, some of the things we might do and say, this proves that I'm a Christian, are things we would do anyway. Not because we believe, not because we're people of faith, but for other reasons. Some of the things we do, which seem to identify us as Christians, we're doing just because of how we were raised. Which means we were raised well. I mean, good on any parent who teaches his child to grow up and be a sort of biblical person. And yeah, you can make a case for the fact that better be a biblically behaved person for any reason than not to be biblically behaved, but some people grow up and they live that sort of life just for the fact that that's how they were raised to live. And so they live as that sort of parent, you know, generally taking the biblical role and being parents in a biblical way. Some people are that way as neighbors. And they take up their place in the community and live a sort of well-behaved life as a neighbor or as a citizen just because that's what they see to do. That's what they feel like doing. That's what they've been raised to do. And the same thing would be true of how some people are brothers or sisters. You know how you fit in with your own brothers and sisters? Or how you are daughters or sons, how you fit in with your parents and continue to relate to parents. There could be a whole lot of works without faith. There could be a whole lot of right action, even though it's not faith that motivates you. We're looking at Abraham, who obeyed, which was the right thing to do. It's what God had called him to do, but he obeyed by faith. And some people obey just because they're smart enough to see that doing it God's way makes, you know, a lot of sense. And some people are obeying God just because they're safety conscious, and they realize that to do anything other than God's way is going to be, you know, dangerous. And some people are obeying God just because they're efficient. They think in terms of efficiency and they realize it's a waste of time to go other ways or go the right way. They're doing the right thing. Perhaps I have confused you. So let me try to straighten this out. I would want to say, yeah, there's such a thing as works without faith. You can do the right thing without faith. But there's actually no such thing as obedience without faith. Because obeying God is more, here's the big point, obeying God is more than just what you do or what you refuse to do. It has to do with motives. It has to do with intended results. It's not just what you do that defines your faith. It's how you do what you do, and it's why you do what you do. And this is why Abraham is such a great example. Because what we got with Abraham is a man who was called to do a strange thing, and he did it, but what distinguished his actions as driven by faith was not just what he was doing, but also why he was doing it and how he was doing it. So we move on to the second note. As we consider this picture of a man who had everything going for him, he was a wealthy man living in a city called Ur, a godless city, and then God somehow breaks into his life and calls him to a different land, and he goes by faith to this different land. Here's note number two. Faith requires us to be convinced of things not seen. And I want you to see that Abraham is an important example under the heading of verse 1. Abraham's an example of faith as considering faith as the assurance of things hoped for, faith as the conviction of things not seen. And he is a good example to us then of faith because he's a man who is convinced of things not seen. This is what all of verse 8 says. So here's all of verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. If you could have seen him while he was making his trek from Babylon, the area of the world that is now Iraq, to Israel, the area of the world which is now Israel, you would have seen a man doing a thing, a particular thing. It was noticeable. He was on the move, but it wasn't like a wildly unusual thing. He was immigrating. He was just going to a place. Immigrating is not all that unusual. Many of you have, in fact, immigrated. You got here by immigrating. And I would dare say that all of us who did not get here by immigrating are the descendants of those who did immigrate. Everyone. Everyone. Even the First Nations people are just the descendants of the people who were first to immigrate. Because southwestern Ontario is a long way from the Garden of Eden. Everyone who got here, walked here somehow or other, took a boat or something, flew, we're all immigrants. Being an immigrant is no particular demonstration of faith until you look at why and how. And Abraham was a person who was immigrating because he was convinced of things not seen. Now the really stark thing about Abraham's example is he hadn't even seen how to get where he was going. He was answering the calls to God. God was calling him to go to a place, but didn't tell him where, and didn't even tell him how to get where. And that didn't stop Abraham from obeying God. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. One step at a time. It was a walk of faith. He walked by faith. All he knew was, if I'm going to keep walking, I need to put the next foot in front of the other. And he just kept walking. This, in verse 8, is a reference to the story as it's told in Genesis. It starts right off the bat with this note. Genesis 12:1 says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." You notice the future tense, right? The land that I will show you. It's not like God sent a map down from heaven and said, go to the land that I am showing you. It was the land that I will show you. Think about the significance of this. God showed it to him in the future, once he got there. But how did he get there when he didn't know where it was? One step at a time. Convinced of things not seen. Convinced that the invisible God really was calling him. And convinced that things that are not present true, like his ownership of that land, would in fact in the future be true. This was what faith looked like, and this is how he went about obeying God. This is why he went out as an immigrant, because God had promised him a land. He went out to find it. And that reviews for us the faith that we saw demonstrated by Abel and by Noah, but it takes it into new detail, which is why we have it here. In verses 8, 9, and 10. So here's the third note as we picture this man going one step at a time. He believes God. So he believes he's going to end up somewhere. In fact, the place that God has promised him. With no idea. And if you know how the wilderness there in the desert land is placed between what is now Iraq and what is now Israel, you get the notion that in order to get west, he had to have gone north. Because he couldn't have gone across the desert. It would have been impossible to take what he was taking across the desert. So it's just a great picture of God's ways. God has a land for Abraham. It's way over to the west. And God leads him a step at a time, way north, and then west, and then way south. He had to go up around this giant U-turn thing to get where God was calling him to go. So it was a long, long trip. And long, long is the whole point of the story, as we see. Because the third note about Abraham as an example to us is a new idea. Another detail about what it means to be a person of faith. Here's note number 3. Faith requires us to remain convinced of things not seen. Turns out that a key ingredient in Abraham's obedience is endurance. So it's not just, what he was doing. He was leaving the land where he was comfortable to go to a place. But it was why, because God had called him, because God had promised him a land. And it wasn't just what and why, it was how. He went with great endurance, not knowing where he was going and not knowing what would happen when he got there. What he found in answer to the question of what's going to happen when I get there is not much. Not much happened. So we get to verse 9, Hebrews 11:9. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land. That was obvious and true. He was going to live. But here's how it worked out. Living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. Abraham's faith caused him to leave where he was going, though he didn't know where. it also required him, once he got there, to believe that he had gotten there, and then just to stay there in a tent, which is a fine thing to think about on a Victoria Day weekend. And aren't you glad that you're not in a tent, considering the weather on this Sunday morning? Looked good yesterday. It wasn't good. It's a rainy Victoria Day weekend. And there are many people in tents for the weekend, and they'll be glad to be home on Monday night and may even come home early. But Abraham got to the place that he was going, and by believing God, he took up the conviction that this place that I'm now living is the place that God is giving me. And so he stayed in a tent. How long, you ask? Well, verse 9 explains. He lived in tents with Isaac, his son, who had not yet been conceived when he got there. And Isaac grew up in a tent. Not just Isaac, but Jacob, Abraham's grandson. He stayed in that tent, or in the replacement tent, because he wore out the first tent, for decades, living in tents. He just lived in tents with Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise, which didn't look particularly like it was going to be fulfilled anytime soon. That's how Isaac would see it, as he, you know, recognized the fact that this is a long camping experience. Been in this tent for, all my life. My dad got here. He's been in this tent for long before I was born. And then there was a grandson, a happy moment. And then Jacob grows up with the same experience, living in tents. Long, long thing. Here's the story. Here's the testimony of Abraham's faith. It was one big, spectacular hike, followed by one very long camping experience. Lived in that tent, there in that provincial park, for a long, long time. The characteristic of his faith, most notable eventually, was the endurance of it. He just kept there. He just stayed there. And it never came to his, he never came to the conclusion that this was turning out to be a dreadful failure. Came here, not knowing where I was going, finally got to a place, didn't look any different from the other places. God said, this is the place. So he just waited for something to happen, and basically nothing did. For the rest of his life, that's the big point that Hebrews 11 ends on, as we will see if we get to the end of the chapter. But one more thing about Abraham's faith. Number 4, Abraham's experience links faith and trust. We saw that the first note linked faith with obedience, but here's the other part of faith. So clearly demonstrated by Abraham, Abraham's experience linked faith and trust because after a long, long while, it was really, really obvious that he was a person of genuine trust because he never went home. He never quit. He never said, well, that didn't work out. I was comfortable where I was, so why don't I just go back? It must have occurred to him to do that. I mean, he was there for decades with his son and his daughter-in-law, with his grandsons, but he never did. And why not? This is what verse 10 tells us. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. He just stayed where God had led him because of what he was looking forward to, because of his assurance of a thing that was only hoped for, because of his conviction about things that he could not see, both God, who could not see because God was spiritual, and his ownership of the land and the city that was going to be there in that land, because God had promised him that there would be a city. He was looking forward to that city, a city that had particular foundations whose designer and builder is God. This is what trust looks like, which is what faith looks like. Real faith is linked to trust. And he lived in a state of trust for the rest of his life. And very notably, never did get what he had been promised personally, though his descendants got it in ways far beyond his own ability to comprehend. There he was for the rest of his life. What he had was a campsite. But what he'd been promised was a city, and not just any city. He had left a city. He had a city before, but a particular sort of city, a city designed and built by God. So as we think about being people who make use of the energy we have and the time we have and the abilities we have and the money we have to take opportunities to serve God. We are being served notice in capital letters that we need to do so. We need to take our opportunities with great endurance. And it just won't do at all to summon up a great bunch of spiritual energy and plunge out and with one great reckless sense of abandon go do some great thing of faith. And if it works, good. And if it's not, we promise ourselves never to do that again. We need to approach the whole idea of trusting God and obeying God with such faith, with such trust, and with such obedience that we're willing to endure in our obedience, even if we're not seeing any particular obvious results for doing so, because Abraham is set for us as an example, and that's what he did. Now, real practically, talking about living in 2011, let me give you a tip on endurance. A tip that comes from the very next chapter in Hebrews, so it's pretty plainly relevant to chapter 11. A tip that's based on the metaphor, one I'm fond of the life that we're called to live as followers of Christ in comparison to an endurance race. Here's Hebrews 12, 1 and 2. In view of everything we learn from Abraham, from Noah, from Abel, before him, and the ones who we will see afterwards, here's what the writer says as he starts what we call chapter 12. Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. And that, which is the beginning of verse 2, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, is the tip, is the hint of how to endure. We can compare this description of Jesus as the founder and perfecter of faith to the description of God in chapter 11. God, the designer and builder of the city. Abraham was looking for a city which had foundations, whose designer and builder is God. And now we are told, as followers of Christ, to look to Jesus as the founder and the perfecter of our faith. Look to him. Look to him. And in what sense can we do that? Because that's the tip. If you want to endure, keep looking to Jesus. And someone should say, faith is the conviction of things not seen, and some things are not seen because they're spiritual, not physical, especially God, the immortal, invisible God. And for all intents and purposes, Jesus is invisible too, because he's there at the right hand of God and he's not here in this space and time. He's outside of our own experiences and our own dimensions. So how do you look to him? Well, it is a figure of speech. But I think how you look to him is you keep your focus upon him and you do what you're doing in obedience to him. You do what you do with the design of it meaning something to him. It's meaningful to you because it will mean something to him that you do it in his name or you do it to obey him. I think this notion here, this tip in Hebrews chapter 12 links really clearly with what Jesus said the night he was betrayed to his apostles. John 14 verse 21, he says to them, and so now says to us, whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. Jesus says, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. Metaphorically speaking, who are the people who really see Jesus clearly? Those that he has manifested himself to, made himself clear to. And who are the people he manifests himself to? It's really plain. Those that he is in a love relationship with, driven from our side by our inclination to keep the commandments that we have, to do what he's called us to do, to demonstrate our love that way. This is what it means to look to Jesus. In regard to everything we decide to do, whether it's a sort of regular, everyday sort of obedience, you know, like obey the law and try to stay out of jail, or whether it's a spectacular obedience, like go to a land that you've never been to, as God will show you how. In every case, obeying the commandments of God because we love Jesus and we want him to see our love acted out. Because Jesus says, those who do, I will love and manifest myself to. And so then you'll have a clearer view of Jesus than ever before. You'll see him, metaphorically speaking, way more clearly than you saw him before. And that will motivate you to get on with more thoroughgoing obedience. And not just what you do, doing the right thing, refusing to do the wrong thing, but why you do it. You do it to be pleasing to him. You do it to get more connected to him. You do it as part of your relationship to him. That's the tip. You want to keep enduring in your faith? You want the strength to keep doing what God's calling you to do? Then make it personal. Do it for Jesus. Do it because it will mean something to him, because it means something to you that you could do something that would mean something to him. Make it personal. Make it relational. Anybody noticing Abraham living in a tent for decades, and then his son, and then his grandson living in a tent in the land he had been promised, might wonder, what's the timeline here? And the answer would be, none of us knows. It's God's timeline. So then someone theologically minded could say, so what is God doing? What is God thinking that the timeline would be what it is? And I think this tip about looking to Jesus and this idea of making your obedience personal, relational, helps us to figure out the timeline. Because I think sometimes the very long timeline that God sets for our causes and effects, for our obedience and the rewards, the timeline relates to God's relational intentions. Sometimes it's not so much getting something accomplished or changed or done, although of course what you accomplish or change or do is important information, but it's what happens in the process of getting it done. And if it's God's intention to make himself known to his people, and God's desire that we would be people who know him, then maybe we're stumbling onto an answer to the question of why some prayers take so long to get an answer to, and why some prayers remain unanswered for years. Because a prayer that remains unanswered for years is a prayer you continually pray again, right? Here I am again, Lord. You bring your heart to God and you can't help yourself, can you? Just give him again your prayer. You pray again for the person that you're thinking about. You pray again about the problem that isn't being solved. And the ongoing nature of the problem results in an ongoing relationship to God. And you know this from your experience, don't you? The thing that you desired, say, 10 years ago and prayed for with all your heart, if you still desire it and you're still praying about it, you pray differently. Because the experience has changed you. And you're enduring in your faith. You're still convinced of things not seen. And you're still assured of things you hope for. But you're convinced and you're assured in a more mature way, because your faith is more mature, because you are more mature. So does it look sort of lame that the prayer has been unanswered for a decade? Or that Abraham lived in a tent for many decades? If all that matters is results, then instant results would be better than, you know, long-term results. And yeah, something lame is going on. But when you consider the heart of God and the intention of God and why anything even exists, why there's human beings created in the image of God at all, it begins to make sense, I think, that God would deliberately choose to keep us waiting on certain things so that we can learn to hope in a mature way. That faith would become a real rock-solid assurance of things hoped for, a real deep-rooted conviction of things not seen, which makes us more and more like Jesus. And that was the plan, wasn't it? That we would be conformed to the image of Christ? These are the notes on faith that come from the example of Abraham, who lived in a tent with his son and his grandson for a long, long time. And in fact, read the end of the chapter, never did get what he was promised. And was okay with that. Because the results did eventually come, and he died convinced that they would, and saw that he wouldn't himself see it. Which by the end of the story, I think, worked out to be fine with him. This leads us to some questions. Three quick questions for us to take away and feast on. Questions about you and me and our Mateo. Questions about you and me being convinced and remaining convinced of God's faithfulness. Questions about you and me continuing to trust God. Here's the first. I'll ask it of myself, you ask it of yourself. How much, then, do I really trust and therefore obey God? How much of my obedience, how much of me doing the right thing and refusing to do the wrong thing is me trusting God? How many similarities are there between me and my faith experience and Abraham and his? And are we really enduring the way we're called to because we're really trusting and therefore obeying God? Comes down to a question of what opportunities we're taking and what we're doing with our money and our abilities and our time and our energy, but not just what we're doing, not just what opportunities we're taking, but also why we're taking those opportunities and how we're taking them and how we are enduring. These are the questions that pop up around this first question of me and my faith, of you and your faith. That's the first. Now, taking notes from Abraham, here's the second question. You ask yourself, I'll ask myself, how much do I focus on things not seen? How driven am I by my conviction? The things I can't see are actually true. It's just natural for us to focus on the things we see. And there are some people who say about something, I'll believe it when I see it, which is a very difficult position to hold to. Because there's some things then you will never believe, and it's deadly not to believe certain things. But how much do I focus on things not seen? There's a couple ways to go with this, and I will take one because the other we will get to in June. I've decided to stay in Hebrews 11 in June and for 3 weeks look at Moses, another brilliant example of faith. And what we'll see there in the life of Moses coming up from chapter 11 of Hebrews is that faith is a cure for addiction to instant gratification. Sometimes our focus on the things we see is a focus on the desire for instant gratification, and Moses is a brilliant example of how faith can cure us of that need to get it now. But there's another cure that faith offers us, not a cure for addiction to instant gratification. We'll let Moses be the example to us of that. Let Abraham be an example of another sort of cure. This is faith as a cure for worry and fear. Abraham had staked everything on this venture, which in his own lifetime did not pay off. He left his house, moved temporarily into a tent, and never got out of the tent alive. Big picture. He left his tent from time to time, but he always had to go back in. So was there something to worry about? Yeah, of course. Was there something to be afraid of? Well, yeah, he lived in a tent. He lived with worries and fears, right? Here's another tip for managing our present-day challenges and enduring through worry and fear. Get this from a brilliant New Testament example of the same sort of faith. I'm thinking of Paul. I've been looking at 2 Corinthians 4 a lot lately. And here's what Paul says in regard to his horrendous suffering for the gospel. He gives the details of his horrendous suffering in 2 Corinthians. But in chapter 4, speaking of it, he says, oh, this is so brilliant. He says, this man who's been tortured for his faith repeatedly, he says, for this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. And here you see it so clearly explained that Paul was able to take the torture in stride because he was focusing on things not seen. And focusing on the things not seen, which was the eternal weight of glory, changed his view of his present worries and fears and sufferings, so that the present worries and fears and sufferings seemed to him a light thing, a momentary thing, light momentary affliction. It's remarkable when you read in 2 Corinthians what kind of suffering he had suffered, light momentary affliction. Paul's alternate focus, his tendency to focus on the things that you can't see, changed the way he looked at the things that he could see, gave him a more complete context to understand the difficulties of present-day life. So it's significant. We should ask ourselves a question and not let ourselves go until we get the answer. How much do I focus on things not seen? How much are the long-term invisible consequences what I care about the most? And that leads to the third and the final question, which is the question that we started this series with and the previous series a year before. What is my Mateo? What is God telling me to do? What opportunity am I to take because I've got the energy for it, the time for it, the abilities for it, the money for it? And considering Abraham's life and the nature of his obedience and the point of endurance, let me point out again that it might be, let me make this really clear as I shut this thing down, it might be that the opportunity that God is driving you to take this year, the opportunity that you should write out on a Mateo card, if anyone would ever hand you one, is to continue doing what you're already doing. Because you've already loaded up your plate nicely with godly duties at home, regarding your marriage or your single life, godly duties to your children, who are a major preoccupation of your life because of your godliness, duties at work, duties in the community, and duties to love your neighbor. Maybe there's no new opportunity necessary. You just need to persevere in what you're already doing. But it's not just what you're doing. It's how you're doing it, and it's why you're doing it. That would be an answer to your question, what is my Mateo? And I don't want us all to therefore take a deep breath and relax and say, cool, I don't have to take on any more opportunities. Because maybe that's actually too easy. Maybe there is one other opportunity you ought to fit in with some of your money, some of your abilities, some of your time, some of your energies. But you'd be missing a big deal of the point if you forgot the fact that one of the reasons it's difficult to take on new opportunities is you've already taken on so many. And it's really important that you endure in them. Really important you don't quit the good things you're doing in order to take on something else, unless God is distinctly showing you that you need to narrow your focus. But there's some duties that you're not allowed to do that with. So what is my Mateo? Are you going to take it? Have you already taken it? How are you taking it? Why are you taking it? How committed are you to remaining in it? Because you're so sure of things hoped for. Because you're so convinced of things not seen. May God give us wisdom so that we don't turn away from a brilliant opportunity to do a new thing. Or we unwisely go ahead and take a new thing and drop something that He hasn't shown us we're appropriately able to drop. May God give us wisdom. May God use us individually and collectively to be a great force for good as we trust God enough to obey Him. And as we are so relationally oriented, we are able to hear what God is calling us to hear and do what God is calling us to do. May God give us wisdom to His glory. Amen. Let's pray.